Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursa Goodness. The show can also be heard on KOWA LP Olympia, Washington, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KXCF in Marshall, California, and WCRS LP in Columbus, Ohio. This episode originally aired on December 28, 2013, and features an interview by William Goodenough with Paul Z. Simons of Modern Slavery magazine. What you say, what you say, what you say,
what? Like a boy. Earlier this month, the United States Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments in the appeal of Ohio death row prisoner Bomani Shakur, whose government name is Keith Lamar. Bomani is one of the five prisoners prosecuted as the Lucasville Five, targeted as ringleaders of the weeks-long prisoner uprising that occurred at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, Ohio, in 1993. If you do the math, you realize this is a 21-year-old legal battle so far. Bomani was identified, targeted, prosecuted, and condemned to death strictly on the testimony of other prisoners. There existed no security footage, no DNA, no fingerprint evidence, only the accounts of other convicted felons who may or may not have had their own motives to lie, who may or may not have attributed their own criminal behavior to Bomani. And while hundreds of prisoners were involved in the uprising, investigators only collected statements, it seems, from less than 100 of them. So we must conclude that either hundreds of prisoners had no idea what occurred, suffering mass amnesia, or investigators simply chose not to take note of their accounts. Bomani himself has written extensively. His account was published last year, entitled Condemned. It's an excellent read, and is very revealing with regard to the tactics the state used in its frame-up of targeted prisoners in the aftermath of the riot. I sent my copy to Governor Jaywow, who never even had the courtesy to write me back and tell me what he thought of the book. What an ingrate. So anyway, the hearing. The reason this court hearing was so crucial is that the U.S. Court of Appeals would either decide to vacate Bomani's conviction or to set an execution date. Since the U.S. Supreme Court hears only 3% of cases, that means this was Bomani's last good shot at being heard. Bomani wasn't permitted to attend, of course, but more than 100 supporters packed the courtroom. His attorney, David Dalton, was also there, but Bomani and his attorney haven't been on speaking terms for quite some time. Imagine that. Facing execution and being excluded from a hearing where your only hope is in someone who isn't speaking with you, to convince three judges who never met you that you shouldn't be strapped to a table and murdered. The panel hearing arguments was composed of two white conservatives appointed by Bush and one black centrist appointed by Clinton. Not exactly a dream for a black prisoner condemned in the death of a white guard, a conviction rubber-stamped by lower courts for 21 years. But, according to observer accounts, the arguments went incredibly well. Links to a report back and even the audio of the hearing can be accessed online. The principal argument presented by Bomani's attorney is the unfairness of the state withholding important evidence. In a process never previously employed in any other case, prosecutors at Bomani's trial gave his attorneys a list of prisoner names and a stack of anonymous statements. It was left to counsel to attempt to mix and match statements to the prisoners who made them, and then attempt to figure out which statements were credible and which ones impeached which. The judges even referred to this as a mix-and-match game and asked the prosecutor why such a process was undertaken. The prosecutor could provide no coherent answer, and one judge followed up to clarify that not even the prosecutor could justify such a process, one that could only be, by design, an effort to confuse and obstruct Bomani's defense. Instead, the prosecutor intended to argue some kind of procedural minutia that Bomani's attorney shouldn't have filed something within a legal time frame because that time frame was going to change in the future. In other words, the court should ignore a deliberate injustice and murder an innocent man because his counsel didn't exercise psychic powers to anticipate a future change in court rule. So the real question before the Court of Appeals is whether the courts will turn a blind eye to prosecutors and prison officials scapegoating those they don't like, killing with a needle the fortunate few that the Darren Wilsons don't happen to shoot.
This call is originating from an Ohio correctional institution and may be recorded or monitored.
The real question is whether the United States will yet again become the murderer that Bomani is falsely accused of being. Free the Lucasville Five. Check out the links where this segment gets posted. This is Ohio Governor and Exile-elect Sean Swain from Ohio Supermax Facility. If you're listening, you are the resistance.
You can write to Sean Swain at Sean Swain, number 243-205, OSP, 878, Coitsville, Hubbard Road, Youngstown, Ohio, 44505. To read some of Sean's writings and learn more about his case, check out seanswain.org. For more information about Bomani Shakur's appeal, check out lucasilamnesty.org.
We're speaking with a contributor and editor of the recently published journal Modern Slavery, whose website is modernslavery.calpress.org. I was wondering if you'd like to just introduce yourself for the radio.
Sure. My name is Paul Z. Simons, or at least that's the nom de plume that I use. I guess that's all you need for an introduction. That's who I am.
You're an author, right? You've written a bunch of books.
I have written a bunch of articles. Got started in the 80s. Was associated with the Anarchist Switchboard, which was kind of a holdover from the 70s and kind of the up against the wall motherfucker group. And it was dying when some friends and I found it, but we got in there and immediately started writing a zine called Black Eye, which included some folks who are actually still writing and still doing stuff in the milieu. Then there's, you know, Jason McQuinn, who at that point in time was Lev Cherney out of Anarchy. He and I were back and forth. So we put out, I think, 7 or 8 editions of it, which, you know, for zine life, that was phenomenal. Most zines survived past 2 or 3. So I spent long hours at my place of work doing Xerox ninja work.
It seems to be a radical rite of passage.
I miss it, you know, because I see a lot on the internet in terms of people getting material out. But there was something about having that zine, particularly living in a large city, you know, you could pull it out, you could read it on the subway train, and, you know, and some of the stuff that came out, even some of the cartoons and whatnot were brilliant. You know, you just couldn't avoid how funny they were.
Could you tell us a little bit about the journal Modern Slavery and how it was first kind of conceptualized?
Sure. You know, kind of the birth pangs for it begin with Anarchy, A Journal of Desire Armed, which I think I did the editing for that magazine for like 3 or 4 issues. And then Jason had done it for, you know, just forever. And what had happened with that journal is that we had moved pretty quickly over the course of the 90s into a place where, you know, we'd become a great deal more individualist. We'd become a great less enamored of kind of the left-right pseudo fighting back and forth. And we're also, you know, in terms of looking at where capital was, some of this stuff is stunning in terms of what it's been capable of accomplishing over the course of, you know, the past 3 or 4 decades. Neoglobalism, I think, you know, it will take centuries to try to put together just exactly how it's been able to do what it's done.
For sure.
In terms of effectively eliminating all contestation. You know, what is good appears and what appears is good. That's incredible. So anyway, the bottom line is that we kind of all this stuff happening together, as well as, you know, 1999, the World Trade Organization, Seattle, really showed that anarchists had teeth and that they could bite back. So I think all of that kind of came together and we started talking about, he had given editorship of Anarchy over to a group of folks out of Oakland. And he and I got talking again about maybe doing something. We were interested in being able to produce larger pieces. And we're also interested, obviously, I'm interested personally in producing a little bit more cultural stuff, because I think one of the things that anarchist writers have been weak on is really engaging with culture and trying to make some sense of what is being produced at the level of art and how does it interact with the political or the anti-political. And that's always fascinated me. So we've kind of gone into that. For instance, with MS number 2, we had the Grand Guignol as well as the goth story from Bruno Massey. So I really like that. I like the fact that we're kind of getting into it. When we're also, I think, putting out some of the material, some of the essays that I'm hoping people are reading and aren't being scared of, turned off by. You know, we came into it with a whole bunch of commitments to ourselves in terms of writing. And one of the big ones was to be able to write in language that people got. I think that one of the reasons that the left is the left, a handful of people on the face of the earth can actually read.
That's one thing I definitely appreciated about the articles that I personally have read. And in the introduction, the call outs, if you can't pronounce the word, you shouldn't use it. If you can say something in 5 words, don't say it in 15. You know, I like that a lot about the call out.
For Jason and myself, and I think for all the writers, it's a real standing commitment, because we see that as, you know, if anything, it makes that Caucasian chalk circle of the left even tinier. I pick up Zizek is actually the classic example of that, where, you know, he'll lose me within pages. It's like, wow, I am lost.
Yeah.
And I really want to interact with this guy at an intellectual level, you know, because I don't like some of his stuff, but I'd like to know what he's talking about. But
right. By
the time he's digging into Lacan and the real and the imaginary, it's like, man, you left me on page 6.
Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah, it does suck. It makes politics extremely rarefied, too, in my opinion. It becomes something else other than dispersal of information, you know, a communication of an idea. It just becomes so many pages of intellectual masturbation, as it were.
And that's kind of my own personal thing, and I think it falls out actually of the Grand Guignol piece, but even the James Brown piece as well. To me, there's a mental piece to politics, but there's also a gut piece to it as well. There is an irrational piece to politics, which I think that the more you try to eliminate, the stronger it becomes. And so there's got to be some level of balance between, you know, what I'm feeling at the level of my heart, my gut, and what I'm doing at the level of practical politics.
And I think that's especially marked within anarchism, which sort of like leads me into my next question, which is about the politics of modern slavery. I found it pretty interesting that the introduction of the first issue characterizes the journal as an anti-ideological libertarian journal. But
right.
I did notice that a good amount of the contributors appear either to have worked on anarchist projects or to be anarchists themselves. I'm wondering if you could speak to this as a contributor. Are you an editor as well?
Yeah.
Word.
Yeah.
Okay. As a contributor slash editor. And I don't want to be an ideologue or anything, but I'm just curious about the politics of the journal.
Yeah, and it's actually really semantic. One of the things I think Jason is actually more concerned about it than I am. But you know, if you step into any other country other than the United States and you say libertarian, they immediately think anarchist, right? So he is very interested in co-opting libertarianism back into anarchism. So that's kind of a piece of where he's coming from. In terms of the anti-ideological, I think that, you know, getting into that question a little bit, one of the concerns that you see consistently across the board with anarchism is that people have a tendency to harden into certain, you know, niches. In other words, well, you know, I'm an insurrectionist, and so I dress in certain ways, and I interact with certain individuals, and that's pretty much who I am and who I become. And, you know, that's fine. I think the issue that we have as essayists, as trying to think through stuff, is that it cuts us off from material that we might not want to look at, and yet that might speak directly to what we're trying to do. Again, I hate to mention Zizek, but the one thing that he's done is, you know, G.K. Chesterton, who was a real nasty Catholic writer from the end, but he wrote a classic anarchist novel, The Man Who Was Thursday. Anyway, the guy is just nasty as hell, but he really put some stuff on the table that, as an anarchist, I want to interact with, you know.
For sure.
And if I was playing the ideological game, well, I may not want to actually choose him as a foundational piece to work with. So, and I also recognize the fact that, I mean, over the course of, you know, my life at least, you know, my ideas have fundamentally changed. I was very interested in kind of the working class IWW, you know, anarcho-syndicalist type of anarchism when I was younger, and still a wobbly. You know, I probably will carry that card till I die just for the sake of argument. But just because I also think it's important that that organization stay alive. But on the other side of it, now I pretty much see myself as an individualist and somewhat less enamored of the concept of the working class being some type of revolutionary subject. And I guess one of the things that it kind of oozes from as well is that ideology basically proceeds from a number of different definitions. And those definitions over time have really either softened or been destroyed. And I'll give you an example of one. The proletariat, right? Mm-hmm. Classic, you know, standing in the sun, arms folded, I'm going to control the street, that type of thing. What does it mean when most proletarians actually own pieces of the company that they work for?
Right.
Right. So now we're talking about proletarians who are also bourgeois by definition. And if they own their own tools, it gets even worse because now they're not only bourgeois, they're also petty bourgeois.
Right.
And they're also, you know, so I think that Camus basically hit the nail on the head in the 70s in his Wandering of Humanity when he basically said, you know what? Basically, with the triumph of global capital, sometime around 1946, 47, what we saw was the proletarianization of humanity. You cannot speak about an oppressed class or a class that is a subject without mentioning everybody, for all intents and purposes. And that means that on the other side of the street, what we're really fighting against is an idea. Our nemesis, the antagonist in the current struggle is, you know, this concept of this material community, which destroys real community. And of course, he's got to use the German term, which we always have to use sometime, this community, this utopia that I think that a lot of people that I work with at least imagine, hold in their hearts, I'll say that.
Again, you know, leads into maybe or could lead into a discussion of the conception of modern slavery being this very, very diffuse phenomenon that gets pretty viciously internalized with wage slavery, et cetera, et cetera. And I was wondering if you would speak to the parameters as you see them of the conception of modern slavery, which is what the magazine is named after.
Sure. Again, I think that this is, oh God, who is this close to? I'm thinking of a 19th century French philosopher, but basically, you know, if reality is like a bucket of shot, you know, and you pull out little pieces of reality, pull out little behaviors, what have you, and you examine them and take a look at kind of what their effect is on the human psyche and on human organization, that type of thing. The more you do that, the more you recognize that there are very few pieces of society as we know it that are neutral and that present themselves as neutral. That we observe a day-to-day battle primarily between, you know, what is wanted of us, what is asked of us, what is forced of us, and what we actually want to do. You know, when wage slavery is the most obvious piece of that, but the issue is that when you take a look, the one thing I like about the situation is they really nailed it with the city. You know, if you just take a walk through a city, you realize, wow, this city and the way that these avenues are organized are taking me directly to places to shop. They're moving me away from places where I would have, you know, a sitting common like a park or things like that. Parks are generally defined by extremely busy streets.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're difficult to get at. They have these wonderful things that you're supposed to pass through, but not stay and observe for long periods of time. You know, even down to the ergonomics of like a McDonald's or the ergonomics of a large lobby. You know, it really does speak to the triumph of a material community. It's incredible that we could probably sit here all afternoon and talk about, wow, I was just thinking about pants the other day. Do you ever think how confining pants are?
Yeah.
That obviously gets to the ridiculous, but it does point out that we really have incorporated or encapsulated, or Hegel uses the term moment, which is obviously an idealist term, which has resonance for me. I don't know why, because mm-hmm. I don't consider myself an idealist, but every artifact of capital has a moment. And in general, those moments are moments of domination, moments of control, moments that consistently push forward the organization of the species towards greater and greater exploitation, greater and greater, you know, slavery. However, at the same point in time, some things appear almost out of the blue sometimes as moments of insurrection, moments that move directly against the thought, the idea of control. And those are the ones that obviously are interesting. Well, both are interesting for a lot of different reasons, but those moments, and it can also be periods of time, you know, the Occupy thing. I mean, mm-hmm. there are lots of different arguments back and forth about Occupy, but just the very fact that it happened should cause some people to pause. You know, it's like, wow, that was pretty interesting. We should probably think about kind of how that happened and some of the dynamics that were associated with that. Because the important stuff I haven't seen written yet about Occupy and about what it tells us about the social enemy, because they showed their hand when the Occupy movements were closed down, and they're not real strong. I mean, the hand that they showed us was very fragile and scared.
Yeah, you know? For sure.
You know, it's a lot like watching animals in a pen. They were definitely, you know, trying to find some way that they could make this thing work. You know, in other words, destroy freedom of speech at the same point in time protecting freedom of speech.
Yeah, they being like statists and cops and those in power. Is that what you mean?
Exactly, exactly. And you know, the fragility, how almost glass-like the control is at this stage of the game, where it seems like a single strike at the right point would shatter the entire thing.
For sure.
You know?
Yeah. Do you think that we can talk about moments of rupture in a formulatized way? Do you think that we can talk about those as having a definitive beginning point, middle point, end point? What do you think about that?
It's been done. Crane Brinton, who was an analyst at the CIA and also a buddy of Marcuse for some odd reason, went through from the English Revolution to the French Revolution to the American Revolution and kind of talked a little bit about general contours of revolution, kind of what he saw as being pretty consistent. And that's interesting, but it also presents to us kind of how not to do everything. I think when it finally happens, it's going to be something that, A, not many people are going to be expecting. B, I think that it's going to have a lot to do with the economy, because quite obviously, you know, if you were paying attention in 2008, the capitalist world was up against the wall. When they decreased the interest rate from the Fed to zero, there's no place else to go. Basically, they're giving away money at that point in time. And that's interesting. Right. That means that they got pushed to the wall. They barely saved the thing. And next time they may not be so lucky. I mean, there's only so much stuff in the shop you can give away before there's nothing left. Right. So I have a feeling it'll probably boil down to some political stuff. And I also think that if anybody's going to be ready for it, I think that the anarchists are, because we have history of distributing free food. We have history of being able to take land over that has been basically not unused, both in urban areas and in rural areas as well. I also think that we're sufficiently principled to be able to organize a militia that's not going to turn into some type of warlordism. And I also think that nobody else is going to know what to do. Everybody else is going to be waiting for Big Brother to come along and to kind of show the way. So I think it's going to be a very different animal than what has happened in the past. And I think it will look more like collapse than it will revolution or insurrection in the beginning, which is not bad.
Yeah, and one might lead to the other, I would imagine.
Exactly. Well, in the same, I mean, with the French Revolution, kind of all the stale arguments about the Ancien Régime, about the king being effectively the representative of God on earth and the aristocracy being, you know, his representative across the country and things like that. Nobody believed that.
Yeah.
You know, even, you know, the problem that they had with the church in part of the French Revolution was all the priests were atheists, right?
Right.
So that's an example of a collapse, but a collapse at a conceptual level. Now we're talking about a collapse at a physical level. And I think that it seems pretty obvious that we're getting pretty darn close to that potential. And that's mirrored again in this fragility. It's like power can no longer accept any question or any loss of its sovereignty over any piece of land. And especially true for the U.S. I mean, you know, think back to the, as long as we're on, started on Occupy, think how rapidly, and think of that phone call that by definition is illegal between CIA and all these, you know, NSA, and how they're going to close all these different occupation sites down at once, right?
Right.
I mean, CIA, by congressional fiat, is not supposed to operate within the United States. So, but regardless, they did. And so that level of consistency and that level of fear, and especially from like an Obama who had some at least mild appeal to, you know, the underclasses, goes to show how scared they truly were.
Word. Yeah, yeah. I agree with that. And you touched on this a little bit, but I'm wondering if you can see any tools that might combat that pervasive internalized statism that we all have. You mentioned, you know, anarchists having really good, solid models for distributing food and for perhaps protecting themselves from certain things. Are there any other tools that you can see that would help with survival or even combating the state as it is pre-potential collapse?
Sure. No, I mean, well, at the level of concept, we're really good at writing and we're really good at putting out our writing and the materials that we've got. So that's really good. And, you know, with the mainstream media, again, we talk about fragility. I have never seen anything so consistently single messaged in my entire life. I haven't watched it for years, but when I do, the difference between a CNN and a Fox and an MSNBC is minuscule, mm-hmm. you know? It's like you get a whole bunch of patriotic stuff. I saw this one. It was like a couple of weeks ago. It was the news, and they were encouraging everybody to go out and buy one thing that was made in America. It's like, this is the news? The other thing is that I think that continuing to work within the system, you know, because there are anarchists everywhere. There are anarchists spread throughout a lot of the bureaucracies, certainly the bureaucracies that are responsible for public health, certainly there are bureaucracies that are responsible for health and human services. And so those are good places for us to be. I think in terms of pushing back against the state, the demonstrations, the manifestations that are currently going on and that will probably continue are just, it's phenomenal. And I also like, because now we get a little bit of the chatter back and forth from the police departments about what they're thinking about it when they find out that anarchists are going to show on the scene. They're very interesting as well, you know. In other words, they're scared to death. When they find out that anarchists are going to be there, they all of a sudden feel their sphincters tingle because it's like, you know, they know what it's like to deal with principled folks who are willing to do just about anything. That scares them, right? And it's a whole different animal than just people marching back and forth with signs. So I think that that begins the process of getting folks to think about it. Also, and this is one of the things that I take from the Spanish Civil War, actually in the Spanish thing, Durruti and Escazo were consistently going into the outback. They were, you know, basically throwing the mayors out of towns and declaring libertarian communism and then, you know, fighting their way out and ultimately ending up in jail for, you know, 2 or 3 months and then being freed by the Spanish working class. If you think of the control and domination of the U.S. and you think of how fragile it is, I can't help but thinking that there might not be a place, you know, somewhere, maybe in the Southwest or maybe in Cascadia, where a group of people would just throw the bums out, raise a black flag and see what happens.
Sean Swain tried to do that with the entire state of Ohio. Did you hear about this?
I did, actually.
Don't want to be the next governor of Ohio. I want to be the last governor of Ohio.
Well, and on the right wing has been playing around with this for years with their free state movement, Wyoming, and then I think it was New Hampshire or whatever. Mm-hmm. So everybody left and right are kind of pushing towards decentralization, which is, you know, makes perfect sense. I just, boy, decentralizing Wyoming is a hellish state to try to make a living in, you know?
For sure.
So there's that. That strikes me as being a real challenge. You know, that would be a dicey call, but you know that the state would overreact, and that overreaction would drive people, I think, into the arms of the anarchists and make them wonder, who are these people? How did they get to the place that they're at? And what were they trying to establish? What exactly was it that they were seeking to accomplish with the seizure of this town or this small, you know, piece of land or whatever? Plus, you know, and this is me speaking from the gut. Wouldn't it be fun to stand on a piece of free ground, even for 10 or 15 minutes?
Oh, hell yeah.
Where no laws apply, there is no government.
Absolutely.
That'd be worth 50 years of fighting.
You talking about that reminds me of all of the informal, I use that word kind of loosely, but like informal little a anarchisms of a bunch of very marginalized, very poor people who live pretty rurally. You know, just read something about it in Bell Hooks, and she was just like, well, all these people, they don't really cotton to any laws. They don't really, they sort of hunt where they want. They take resources and they use them how they wish. And I'm interested in that too, for sure, as a strategy for maybe combating pervasive internalized statist notions or whatever.
Sure. Oh yeah, and people have been trying to get around it for years. In part of the illegalists, you know, the illegalists, most of them get rolling and get introduced to each other in a real fascinating way, which was, what was it, 1904, 1905, France introduced draft laws. And so what these young men at the age of 20 were doing is they were kind of gravitating towards Brussels. And while in Brussels, you know, they were meeting with each other, and most of them found that they were anarchists. And so once they'd gone through their 20th year, go back to Paris and begin the process of forming these illegal combinations, the Bonneau Gang, for all intents and purposes. But there was an interesting quote from one of the authorities where within 4 years of the passage of this bill regarding military induction, that they estimated that 70,000 Frenchmen were either in violation of it or had completely skipped out of the country or were basically deserters. 70,000. That's like almost a generation.
That's beautiful.
Talk about scofflaws. But it goes to show that given the opportunity to squeak out of, you know, some of those responsibilities, and let's face it, I mean, if you can't get people to go and fight and die for you, you're in trouble as a nation state, because that defines you. For sovereignty real. Is a function of the monopoly of force. And if people aren't going to be that force, you got some trouble. So it's no wonder that, you know, World War One was such a dicey experience, because everybody knew it was such a slaughter that, wow, how long are these kids going to take it before they start pointing their weapons at us? And obviously it wasn't long. I mean, there were tons of mutinies all up and down. So I think that there's a gut level response to the government, which even, you know, mainstream media, all the tools of domination, all the tools of control will never be able to get at. Because ultimately people have a desire, I think, for autonomy. People have a desire to basically be left alone. Freedom to me is kind of a negative thing. I just don't do anything. Leave me alone. And I think that, you know, again, we're seeing that over and over again. What they estimate, that one out of three Americans doesn't pay their taxes because they refuse to. The IRS is, you know, basically relying upon most of the wealthy Americans because nobody else wants to chip in. So it's kind of an interesting period in time.
Acts like scamming food stamps, or dare I even mention shoplifting, or...
Yeah, again, kind of digging into the illegalists. There's some international type of stuff going on. The Yomango, do you know this?
I don't think I've heard about that one.
Yeah, this is, it's actually so middle class, it's kind of funny. It violates the whole concept of the proletariat being a revolutionary subject. Basically what it is it's a whole bunch of people. It started in Spain, but it's expanded out to Portugal, and now it's in Brazil. It's basically a whole bunch, like a huge group of middle class people, primarily union members from really well-established unions, who go and shoplift a store one day. They literally take everything out of it. You know, and there's obviously nothing they can do, because you show up with 12 cops and, you know, you've got 600 people, most of them looking like grandma. You're not going to arrest them. So, and again, kind of riffing on larger issues too. And the larger issue there is, you know, basic respect for property, which I don't think ever has actually existed in the minds of most people. I certainly have no respect for property. I don't see it as having an inherent ability to be owned. Which I think property has been perverted. But, you know, regardless of that, you know, there's this whole concept that the force that keeps that food on the shelves and away from me is destroyed by virtue of the fact that the economy, which has a certain level of guarantee that I can get a job and survive, when that promise goes out the window, the other promise goes out the window as well. It's like one thing, if I write anything on my tombstone, it's going to be probably conscience trumps law. Always. I come from a long line of really strange alcoholic lawyers out of Wyoming. And I was always fascinated by García Oliver, was the Minister of Justice in Spain. And I wondered, how does an anarchist become a Minister of Justice? And, you know, he didn't do it very well, and he didn't do it very long. But he did write some interesting stuff about how an anarchist perceives concepts of justice, perceives how to deal with individuals who operate outside of the norms and values of conscience or of human society. It's really interesting, very interesting stuff. I like it because it pushes the bounds of where anarchism is going to have to go. What will we do? You know, what will a local militia do if we find a serial killer? What will the responsibilities be? How will it be handled? Because obviously lynch law is a possibility, but I don't think it's the most humane thing. What can we do with this individual? What are our options? Short of, you know, obviously I think the anarchist solution would not include jailing somebody forever. As a matter of fact, I don't see jails being existing at all. But right. So, you know, what is it? Execution, exoneration, or exile?
Yeah, I don't know. And there's the whole perhaps somewhat polluted concept of transformative justice that has been being bandied about within anarchist circles. And I think that were boundaries to be transgressed in a post-revolutionary, post-collapse society, I think they'd have to be necessarily, you know, viewed on a case-by-case basis.
Oh, yeah. It's there will be tons of work to do. And this is going to be one of the harder ones and one of the ones where I think mistakes will probably be made initially.
Definitely.
But, you know, again, it's important because it just is the nature of human society. But again, the beauty of Bakunin is that his concept of the plasticity of human nature. Mm-hmm. So in other words, in good societies, people have a tendency to behave well. And in evil societies, people have a tendency to behave evil. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And although Bakunin was no great thinker, I think he hit the nail on the head with that one.
You mentioned prison just a little bit ago, and within the context of the journal, I'm curious about a discussion of prison, because I noticed when I was paging through issues, and there's only two issues at this point, it's a relatively new publication, but there isn't really a discussion about the slavery inherent in the modern prison system. And I'm wondering about that. Wondering about why that hasn't yet been mentioned. It's mostly that I've noticed a discussion about the wage economy and wage slavery. Has it just not been gotten to yet? What do you think about that? Or do you have any idea?
Well, it's certainly topical with all the people who have been jammed into federal prison as a result of pretty much entrapment. Obviously, there's a great deal of reason to be writing about prison as well as prison solidarity. The reason that we haven't, and I've written a couple of small things about the Cleveland Five in my weblog, with one of their number basically turning witness for the prosecution, that basically ended their case. Plus, there was no money to defend those poor guys at all. So I would very much like to get into at least one or two of the cases and dig into just exactly what the FBI did, how the material was planted. Because, you know, you hear some of this stuff, like the Cleveland Five is a perfect example. They sold them a cell phone that they said had explosives in it. They taped it to a bridge, and then by punching a number, it was supposed to destroy the bridge. It's like, that's so hard to believe. I can't help but think that there was a lot of other stuff happening there. And the biggest concern right now, I think, is that we are sufficiently scary to them, mm-hmm. that they're looking to find people who are unfortunately may not be wise enough to discern who's a good guy and who's not a good guy. And of course, the bad guys do their best to portray themselves as good.
Certainly, increased policing of anarchist scenes is definitely a really potent issue. I was more thinking about prison as a goods production machine. You mentioned before the news said to buy American, when I think that it's really a brutal tragedy of modern existence that, you know, most of the ish that is made in America is made in prison. And prison labor as something that is driving the goods economy of this country, and it being, you know, in addition to being an extremely racist, sexist, homophobic, all the big bad-ish that happens in society is magnified in prison. I'm wondering if modern slavery is going to speak about prison in that way.
We certainly could. Right now, nobody has picked up that gauntlet, although it's certainly, as you mentioned, there is a lot of material there. I also think that it emphasizes to the internationalism of, you know, the mess. When they say neoglobalism, they mean it, you know, because when I think about prisons that are really engaged in fueling the economy, I'm also thinking about Chinese prison and, you know, how political prisoners there are basically turned into slaves, mm-hmm. right? I mean, if you're working and you're not getting paid, that's like slavery.
Or if you're working and you get paid 40 cents a week, that's even... It's an insulting amount of money. And the 13th Amendment in this country bolsters the enslavement of prisoners.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm delighted that somebody has actually finally read that document. Because, you know, if you read it, the two people who buy themselves out, and I guess this is how the guy on, you know, in the Hawaiian Islands is still operating his slave trade, is any place that's not belligerent or prisons, slavery's okay.
Sure.
So, you know... Wow. There you have it. I always thought that was a fascinating little, you know, prisons are specifically exempt. I think that also it's a really strong metaphor. But then on the other hand, there are intensities of prisons as well. You know, there's kind of the locked in prison. But I keep thinking about, you know, the Palestinians and kind of how they are forced to jump from prison to prison to prison over the course of any given day across Israeli territory. Mm-hmm. You know, so in some instances, prisons have become open air, fenced, and you're jumping literally from prison to prison. And I keep thinking about that in terms of an apartment to a job to maybe another job or maybe relaxation or dinner or whatever. It's also interesting that the Israeli Defense Forces are really, they're talking about this stuff in the context of postmodernism and, you know, relative intensities of violence and things like that. It's really creepy to read some of their stuff. They're like, oh my God, they've been reading Deleuze.
Oh, no, not them, too.
Everybody. Yeah, the Thousand Plateaus, you know.
I'd love to talk more about art and creative endeavors, maybe through talking about your article about the Théâtre du Grand Guignol. Is that how you pronounce it?
Uh-huh.
Would you describe that article that you wrote?
Sure. Initially, it gets started, the Theater Libre, you know, the free theater, which was the beginning of the Théâtre du Grand Guignol, was basically a naturalist experiment where they were trying to present kind of the lives and languages of the underclasses, but they were trying to do it, and they were meant to be nasty. They were meant to use street language and street argot, and they were meant to kind of like drive at bourgeois mores and codes and morals and things like that. It lasted for about 6 or 7 years, and one of the directors of it, a guy named Oscar Metenier, walked away from it with this idea that, you know, the most popular plays that we did were kind of bloody and kind of strange. Maybe these Parisians and people who are interested in seeing these plays would appreciate a good, solid theater of fear. So he sat back for about a year and started thinking through. He got his hands on a theater, obviously, and found a backer. And initially, from the first day, what they were looking to do was to present in theatrical form what Parisians were reading on a daily basis, either in Le Petit Parisien, which was literally a scandal sheet, which would tell stories of, you know, rape, incest, immorality, bourgeois decadence, that type of thing, murder, homicide, you know, you name it, it was in there. It was all illustrated in gaudy colors and things like that. So the Parisians seemed to enjoy that stuff. So all they did is they took some of this material, turned it into plays, and that became the Théâtre du Grand Guignol. It was very popular in its time, started in 1890 or so, and through right until the beginning of World War I, was one of three stage experiences that every tourist wanted to do, the others being the Folies Bergères and the Comédie Française. So it was very popular, which is real strange because, you know, by 1910, things were getting pretty bloody. They were doing all sorts of wild stuff. Just to give a feel for one of the plays, I actually just read this play, finally got my hands on a thing. It's called Crime in a Madhouse. Mm-hmm. Basically, three old women in an insane asylum, a doctor and a nurse decide to go out and have dinner. They leave. A pretty young inmate comes in, and the three old insane women get talking, and they're convinced that there is a mockingbird which is stuck in this young woman's head. So they gouge out her eye to try and find it, but of course they don't find it. And then one of them starts getting worried about getting in trouble for blinding one of the inmates. And so she pushes the woman who blinded this young woman, pushes her head against a heater, basically causing it to burn horribly. And that's the end of the play. So the interesting thing about the play is that obviously there's no morality there at all. Mm-hmm. You know? There's no, you know, right or wrong, just go flying right out the window with a lot of these plays. Things happen that just have no rhyme or reason to them. Violence occurs, and that's just how it is. The interesting piece of it is, it's kind of when you sit back and think about it, and you think about who was going to these plays, which was primarily middle-class audiences, a lot of people were fainting, a lot of people were disgusted by it, but the theater was there basically pushing them as hard as they could, saying, you know, regardless of how wonderful Paris looks, La Vie Lumière, you know, this wonderful place, that some of these passions are still happening and still happening in some pretty interesting places, in places that you wouldn't expect. and you guys aren't doing anything about it. This still exists. Your society, your spectacle have not eliminated any of this material at all. So it's not really a finger pointing, and it's not really pushing the envelope in terms of, oh my God, this terrible thing. It's the very fact that this tableau exists causes fear, causes the revulsion, I think. And of course, they were intrepid in terms of the work that they did. They were really precocious when it came to their stage tricks, you know, arms being cut off, eyes being gouged out, what have you. So they really kind of moved beyond the classic horror into a place where they were actually pointing out, I think, some of the issues with French society. But doing it, and this is interesting to me, they were not doing it from a conservative angle or from a revolutionary or insurrectionary angle. It was very much from an angle of kind of an artist standing, observing, and the feeling of revulsion that one gets from the writer. That's the molding of this new thing. So as opposed to civilization causing, at worst, resignation, at best, acceptance, it now produces the emotion of revulsion.
Do you think that horror has a similar galvanizing effect that might have been intended by the people that put the theater of fear on?
Some do and some don't. Torture porn doesn't really interest me, but then on the other hand, the torture porn like Eli Roth and the stuff that came out in the late 90s produced in France over the course of the past 10 years or 15 years, probably some of the best horror films that have been produced in the past 50. Just unbelievably well done. But of course, these are French. You know, they took the torture porn and they turned it into something that forced you to think about what was going on in the scene as opposed to forcing you to just watch blood flow and arms fall off and that type of thing. So it has the potential for that, but then a lot of genres have the potential for that. Do you remember The Baffler, which came out of Kansas City, Missouri? It was a really well-done zine. It was like a quarterly. One guy wrote in The Baffler about a male porn star in, you know, gay porn films. And he did just a really good job of pointing out the ways that this porn star just really was throwing it back in the face of bourgeois morality. Mm-hmm. And it struck me that there are moments of insurrection all through the Paris cinema. You're not going to get it out of watching Lincoln by Spielberg, but you're going to get, you know, obviously, but you're going to get it out of some of the material that you can find. And again, the fun part, the interesting part is to look through the material and all of a sudden, you know, find, wow, that really is interesting because it questions this. By way of example, if we get it, I guess we're going to probably get into Cannibal Holocaust for a little bit. So I got this anonymous email from somebody after reading the Grand Guignol, and they said, oh, you should check out Cannibal Holocaust. It's a perfect artifact to dig into. So I, of course, I downloaded it and watched it, and I was just like, oh, God. And then I got into a little bit of the film, and the film itself, it kind of doesn't stop when the movie's over because it had this huge controversy associated with it. Mm-hmm. The director almost had to go to jail because they were convinced it was a snuff film. So it's a rather a complex film as well. But I mean, without going too deeply into the film is basically about a documentary crew that goes back into this place called the Green Inferno. They're looking for native tribes who are cannibals, and they want to get the best footage, the type of footage that they can bring out and broadcast. Okay. So in the process of doing that, they torture, they kill these cannibals. And so the name Cannibal Holocaust, and there are scenes in there that are immediately reminiscent of when the Germans went into Eastern Europe and rounded all the Jews up into synagogues and burned them down. So there's a scene like that. And then there is a scene burned into my memory, at least from the Vietnam War, actually during the Cambodian incursion, where a soldier lights a hut on fire using a Zippo lighter. And that scene is reenacted in this movie. So Diodato, who's the director, is pointing a lot of fingers at the U.S. saying, this is what you did, and this is how you filmed it. A lot of this stuff is directly on you. It's really interesting. And also, remember when this is being filmed. So this is being filmed in September and October of 1979, which is, of course, the end of the Carter administration and the election of Ronald Reagan. Now, if there's one thing that Diodato is he's engaged politically. So he is seeing the U.S. fundamentally change. And I think he's giving some clues as to what he sees going on with that. So there's a scene where the documentary crew catches a abortion. And a woman is being forced to abort a fetus. We're not really told why, but the fetus is pushed into the mud and killed. Okay, so maybe he's talking about anti-abortion. But then the woman who had the abortion is clubbed to death by these other women who are conducting this ritual. And again, I wonder how many people are getting, wow, this is when the abortion fight really heated up. Reagan came in. This was going to be one of his issues, to make abortion illegal, to make the murderess pay for what she's done, right? So, and that's just kind of like an overview of this. But then while this is going on, it's the very first found footage film. So while this is going on, we're viewing, you know, this documentary crew basically forcing the natives to torment them, basically tormenting the natives. We're also getting the violence of the boardroom, where the board members, the executives, are deciding, wow, what should we show? What should we not show? This is really powerful stuff. And then we also get, interestingly, the apologetic violence of the university. We have the anthropologist who went into the Green Inferno and retrieved the film, and who's going to basically act as an MC for the film, and he's smoothing over some of the issues and trying to present them in a way such that the capitalists get it, and so that they can produce a film that A, is humanitarian, but B, which produces a lot of money. So we get all sorts of violence. So the film crew, obviously, the cannibals have enough, have had enough of them, and they kill them and eat them, you know, with good reason. So, you know, the cannibals kind of coming out are kind of the hero, because they're just kind of defending themselves the only way that they really can. And everybody else comes out extremely tainted. It's very interesting film. And obviously, there's some wild images that are associated with it, and including the issues around the snuff part. I also found the snuff part kind of funny, because my next blog, I have to do it before Christmas because it only can count for Christmas, is going to be, Yes, Virginia, There Are Snuff Films. Because I'm convinced that, you know, the real snuff films that we have are war movies. There are ways that the government, the nation state, produces support for itself, generates money for, you know, purchase of war bonds, taxes, and things like that. And in many instances, like I said, with this Vietnam piece, you know that film crew said, why don't you light the hut on fire with your Zippo? You know, I doubt a regular lieutenant, you know, whatever, would think that would be a good idea.
Yeah.
Doesn't feel right.
That cannibal Holocaust, the role reversal, is interesting to me. I haven't seen the film, but it seems that the anthropologists are really the sort of like villain characters, and the cannibals, as you said, are sort of the hero characters in a way.
There's been a couple of actually academic articles written about it, and the academics would come across exactly as you expect academics. Well, the anthropologist is the good guy seeking to even out the power struggle between the executives and the cannibals. And yet, in one of the first scenes that we see in the anthropologist, he's like waving around this revolver and trying to keep these natives off of him. And so he's not the most sympathetic character. I don't know that Margaret Mead was ever packing a pistol when she was doing her stuff. But yeah, so it doesn't really, I mean, everybody gets accused in the movie. And the anthropologist, in many ways, is the worst. He reminds me of, in the review that I wrote for this last modern slavery on the slavery uprising, the one thing that really stunned me was the slave drivers who, you know, were the slaves who translated the day's work from the master into what the slaves were doing, and how that collaborationist mentality really is kind of the mentality of the university. In other words, these are what the masters on Wall Street, or you know, the political masters, basically need us to think and need us to do so that this society works. And further, when things get out of control and the natives get a bit restless, then it becomes their secondary job is to explain that to the masters so that they can do whatever it needs to be done to maintain or control the situation. So in many ways, if you want to talk about collaborationist and the real danger I think, oozes out of the university. I just see it as one of these institutions that in a post-insurrectionary society cannot survive because it's so loaded with ideology. Maybe if we could build large walls around it and have at it or whatever. But I mean, it's pretty creepy. And the fact that nobody really will talk about it in terms of Cannibal Holocaust is kind of interesting. The other piece of Cannibal Holocaust, too, that I like is the director is a hack. Ruggero Deodato basically did a lot of violent, sexual, crazy, you know, an Italian B-movie director. Need I say more? You know, can tell a good story, but the guy is not, he's not Kubrick, you know, he's not real brilliant. He's a hack. But the other piece of Cannibal Holocaust is that with this film crew, you get a sense that behind that film crew, he's speaking through the director of the film crew's name is Alan Yates. He's speaking through Alan Yates. He is directly confessing not only what he's done in the past, but pointing a finger at himself and basically saying, mea culpa, this is what I do too. And you don't often see that. It's a creepy movie in the sense that this hack director who's directed nothing but, you know, sword and sandals and sexual interludes on boats and things like that, all of a sudden makes a movie where every artistic decision is correct. You know, it's almost an argument for the muse actually existing. I mean, it's weird, you know, it's like, wow, you don't often see that. So it's worth a line or two. And I also think that the movie wounds us. One of the ways I came at it in terms of organization, I don't like the post-structuralist very well, but Roland Barthes often speaks to me. I really like some of the stuff that he does because he's doing a lot of thought experiments. One of the ones that I talk about is he has some stills from Eisenstein, and he's going through these stills from Eisenstein, you know, Ivan the Terrible, I think also Potemkin, that type of thing. And he's talking a little bit about the different levels of meaning that he's interacting with as he's turning through these stills. And he talks about the level of communication. So there's a story behind the still. He talks about the level of symbolism, you know, the Tsar, especially Ivan, smoldering insanity, can do anything he wants, is about to destroy, you know, an entire class of merchants, the boyars. And then there's something else. And that's where I really like him, because he is honest enough as an academic and an intellectual to say, is that all? Isn't there something else that holds me in the thrall of this photo? And I think that's interesting, because I think there is in some photos, in some works of art, something that really touches us and leaves marks. And that interests me. And I think the horror has a tendency to do that more than other films in terms of pushing images deeply into the psyche where they remain. I mean, everybody here, I mean, you and I could both say, wow, I saw this movie. I still can't get this one scene out of my head.
For sure.
You know, right?
Yeah.
And like I said, this is the type of stuff I think that we should be doing. You know, I think that just writing about our history, just writing about some of our ideas is great. We got to tackle larger issues. And as much as David Graeber makes me absolutely crazy, I appreciated the fact that he could take on debt. It was pretty academic, especially the beginning. It gets a lot more interesting in the second half. But, you know, it's a read. It's a read, and it's something you don't expect from an anarchist. And that I think, is a really good thing.
And as anarchists, I think that we tend to dismiss artistic endeavors or creative endeavors, whether or not they be artistic. And I like that about modern slavery, that it includes poetry, it includes short stories, it includes book reviews about books that are academic and fiction and non-academic, you know. However, yeah, I find it to be an exciting project.
Thank you.
How might one get a prescription to modern slavery, or how might one become a contributor if one wants to?
We have a website. It is calpress.org. If you go into modern slavery and also do CAL Press, you'll pull up the website. And I think that you should be able to get a subscription there. And then to write for the magazine, we always encourage writing and people sending us stuff. So if you review something, it doesn't need to be too long, 4 to 5 pages. If you're interested in writing a longer piece, we are really looking for longer pieces. So we're not really asking for journalism, but say if you wanted to go deeply into the prison thing, has actually made me stand up and kind of think a little bit about a prison material would be really strong, as well as the fact that it would just, boy, there's a lot of international stuff that you could tease out too.
Word. definitely.
Be an awesome piece. So we always accept stuff, and then people can send it to me. Let me give my email address is Paul, P-A-U-L, at capital C, capital A, capital L, press, P-R-E-S-S, .org.
Word. Paul Z. Simons, thank you so much for talking with me about this. It's been a real pleasure.
William, it has been a real pleasure talking to you. I just enjoyed the hell out of it. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Paul Z. Simons, an editor and contributor to the journal Modern Slavery, a libertarian critique of civilization, which can be found at modernslavery.calpress.org.